The Secret Adversary, Agatha Christie, Chapter 6, A Plan of Campaign. A veil might with profit be drawn over the events of the next half hour. Suffice it to say that no such person as Inspector Brown was known to Scotland Yard. The photograph of Jane Finn, which would have been of the utmost value to the police in tracing her, was lost beyond recovery. Once again, Mr. Brown had triumphed. The immediate result of this setback was to effect a rapprochement between Julius Hersheimer and the young adventurers. All barriers went down with a crash, and Tommy and Tuppence felt that they'd known the young American all their lives. They abandoned the discreet reticence of private inquiry agents and revealed to him the whole story of the joint venture, whereat the young man declared himself tickled to death. He turned to Tuppence at the close of the narration. "I've always had a kind of idea that English girls were just a mite moss-grown, old-fashioned and sweet, you know, but scared to move around without a footman or a maiden aunt. I guess I'm a bit behind the times." The upshot of these confidential relations was that Tommy and Tuppence took up their abode forthwith at the Ritz, in order, as Tuppence put it, to keep in touch with Jane Finn's only living relation. "And put like that," she added confidentially to Tommy, "nobody could boggle at the expense." Nobody did, which was the great thing. "And now," said the young lady on the morning after their installation, "to work." Mr. Beresford put down the Daily Mail, which he was reading, and applauded with somewhat unnecessary vigor. He was politely requested by his colleague not to be an ass. "Dash it all, Tommy, we've got to do something for our money." Tommy sighed. "Yes, I fear even the dear old government will not support us at the Ritz in idleness forever. Therefore, as I said before, we must do something." "Well," said Tommy, picking up the Daily Mail again, "do it. I shan't stop you." "You see," continued Tuppence, "I've been thinking." She was interrupted by a fresh bout of applause. "It's all very well for you to sit there being funny, Tommy. It would do you no harm to do a little brain work, too." "My union, Tuppence, my union. It does not permit me to work before 11 a.m. Tommy, do you want something thrown at you? It is absolutely essential that we should without delay map out a plan of campaign. Hear, hear." "Well, let's do it." Tommy laid his paper finally aside. "There's something of the simplicity of the truly great mind about you, Tuppence. Fire ahead. I'm listening." "To begin with," said Tuppence, "what have we to go upon?" "Absolutely nothing," said Tommy, cheerily. "Wrong," Tuppence wagged an energetic finger. "We have two distinct clues." "What are they?" "First clue, we know one of the gang."
"Whittington?"
"Yes, I'd recognize him anywhere." "Hmm," said Tommy, doubtfully. "I don't call that much of a clue. You don't know where to look for him, and it's about 1,000 to 1 against your running against him by accident." "I'm not so sure about that," replied Tuppence thoughtfully. "I've often noticed that once coincidences start happening, they go on happening in the most extraordinary way. I dare say, it's some natural law that we haven't found out. Still, as you say, we can't rely on that. But there are places in London where simply everyone is bound to turn up sooner or later. Piccadilly Circus, for instance. One of my ideas was to take up my stand there every day with a tray of flags." "What about meals?" inquired the practical Tommy. "How like a man! What does mere food matter?" "That's all very well. You've just had a thundering good breakfast. No one's got a better appetite than you have, Tuppence, and by tea time you'd be eating the flags, pins and all. But honestly, I don't think that much of an idea. Whittington may be in London at all."
"That's true."
"Anyway, I think clue number two is more promising. Let's hear it." "It's nothing much.
only a Christian name, Rita. Whittington mentioned it that day. Are you proposing a third advertisement? Wanted? Female crook answering to the name of Rita? I am not. I propose to reason in a logical manner. That man, Danvers, was shadowed on the way over, wasn't he? And it's more likely to have been a woman than a man. I don't see that at all. I'm absolutely certain that it would be a woman, and a good-looking one, replied Tuppence calmly. On these technical points, I bow to your decision, murmured Mr. Beresford. Now, obviously, this woman, whoever she was saved. How do you make that out? If she wasn't, how would they have known Jane Finn had got the papers? Correct. Proceed, O Sherlock. Now there's just a chance, I admit it's only a chance, that this woman may have been Rita. And if so? If so, we've got to hunt through the survivors of the Lusitania till we find her. Then the first thing is to get a list of the survivors. I've got it. I wrote a long list of things I wanted to know and sent it to Mr. Carter. I got his reply this morning. And among other things, it encloses the official statement of those saved from the Lusitania. How's that for clever little Tuppence? Full marks for industry, zero for modesty. But the great point is there a Rita on the list? That's just what I don't know, confessed Tuppence. Don't know? Yes, look here. Together they bent over the list. You see, very few Christian names are given. They're nearly all Mrs. or Miss. Tommy nodded. That complicates matters, he murmured thoughtfully. Tuppence gave her characteristic terrier shake. Well, we've just got to get down to it, that's all. We'll start with the London area. Just note down the address of any of the females who live in London or round about while I put on my hat. 5 minutes later, the young couple emerged into Piccadilly, and a few seconds later, a taxi was bearing them to the Laurels, Glendower Road, N7, the residence of Mrs. Edgar Keith, whose name figured first in a list of seven reposing in Tommy's pocketbook. The Laurels was a dilapidated house, standing back from the road with a few grimy bushes to support the fiction of a front garden. Tommy paid off the taxi and accompanied Tuppence to the front doorbell. As she was about to ring it, he arrested her hand. What are you going to say? What am I going to say? Why, I shall say, oh dear, I don't know. It's very awkward. I thought as much, said Tommy with satisfaction. How like a woman. No foresight. Now, just stand aside and see how easily the mere male deals with the situation. He pressed the bell. Tuppence withdrew to a suitable spot. A slatternly-looking servant, with an extremely dirty face and a pair of eyes that didn't match, answered the door. Tommy had produced a notebook and pencil. Good morning, he said briskly and cheerfully. From the Hampstead Borough Council, the new voting registrar. Mrs. Edgar Keith lives here, does she not? Yes, said the servant. Christian name? Asked Tommy, his pencil poised. Mrs. Eleanor Jane. Eleanor, spelt Tommy. Any sons or daughters over 21? Now? Thank you. Tommy closed the notebook with a brisk snap. Good morning. The servant volunteered her first remark. I thought perhaps as you'd come about the gas, she observed cryptically and shut the door. Tommy rejoined his accomplice. You see, Tuppence, he observed, child's play to the masculine mind. I don't mind admitting that for once you've scored handsomely. I should never have thought of that. Good wheeze, wasn't it? And we can repeat it ad lib. Lunchtime found the young couple attacking a steak and chips in an obscure hostelry with avidity. They had collected a Gladys Mary and a Marjorie, been baffled by one change of address, and had been forced to listen to a long lecture on universal suffrage from a vivacious American lady whose Christian name had proved to be Sadie. "Ah," said Tommy, imbibing a long draught of beer, "I feel better. Where's the next draw?" The notebook lay on the table between them. Tuppence picked it up. "Mrs. Vandemeyer," she read, 20 South Audley Mansions. "Miss Wheeler, 43 Clappington Road, Battersea. She's a lady's maid, as far as I remember, so probably won't be there. And anyway, she's not likely." "Then the Mayfair lady is clearly indicated as the first port of call." "Tommy, I'm getting discouraged." "Buck up, old bean. We always knew it was an outside chance. And anyway, we're only starting. If we draw a blank in London, there's a fine tour of England, Ireland, and Scotland before us." "True," said Tuppence, her flagging spirits reviving. "And all expenses paid. But oh, Tommy, I do like things to happen quickly. So far, adventure has succeeded adventure, but this morning has been dull as dull. You must stifle this longing for vulgar sensation, Tuppence. Remember that if Mr. Brown is all he's reported to be, it's a wonder that he has not ere now done us to death. That's a good sentence. Quite a literary flavor about it. You're really more conceited than I am, with less excuse. Ahem. But it certainly is queer that Mr. Brown has not yet wreaked vengeance upon us. You see, I can do it too. We pass on our way unscathed." "Perhaps he doesn't think us worth bothering about," suggested the young man simply. Tuppence received the remark with great disfavor. "How horrid you are, Tommy! Just as though we didn't count." "Sorry, Tuppence. What I meant was that we work like moles in the dark, and that he has no suspicion of our nefarious schemes. Ha ha." "Ha ha," echoed Tuppence approvingly as she rose. South Audley Mansions was an imposing-looking block of flats just off Park Lane. Number 20 was on the second floor. Tommy had by this time the glibness born of practice. He rattled off the formula to the elderly woman, looking more like a housekeeper than a servant, who opened the door to him. "Christian name? Margaret." Tommy spelt it, but the other interrupted him. "No, G-U-E. "Oh, Marguerite. French way, I see." He paused, then plunged boldly. "We had her down as Rita Vandemeyer, but I suppose that's incorrect." "She's mostly called that, sir, but Marguerite's her name." "Thank you. That's all. Good morning." Hardly able to contain his excitement, Tommy hurried down the stairs. Tuppence was waiting at the angle of the turn. "You heard?"
"Yes. Oh, Tommy!"
Tommy squeezed her arm sympathetically.
"I know, old thing. I feel the same. It's so lovely to think of things, and then for them to really happen," Tuppence cried enthusiastically.
Her hand was still in Tommy's. They had reached the entrance hall. There were footsteps on the stairs above them, and voices. Suddenly, to Tommy's complete surprise, Tuppence dragged him into the little space by the side of the lift where the shadow was deepest.
"What the—" "Hush!"
Two men came down the stairs and passed out through the entrance. Tuppence's hand closed tighter on Tommy's arm.
"Quick! Follow them! I daren't. He might recognize me. I don't know who the other man is, but the bigger one of the two was Whittington."
Chapter 7. The House in Soho.
Whittington and his companion were walking at a good pace. Tommy started in pursuit at once, and was in time to see them turn the corner of the street. His vigorous strides soon enabled him to gain upon them, and by the time he, in his turn, reached the corner, the distance between them was sensibly lessened. The small Mayfair streets were comparatively deserted, and he judged it wise to content himself with keeping them in sight. The sport was a new one to him, Though familiar with the technicalities from a course of novel reading, he had never before attempted to follow anyone, and it appeared to him at once that, in actual practice, the proceeding was fraught with difficulties. Supposing, for instance, that they should suddenly hail a taxi. In books, you simply leapt into another, promised the driver a sovereign, or its modern equivalent, and there you were. In actual fact, Tommy foresaw that it was extremely likely there would be no second taxi. Therefore, he'd have to run. What happened in actual fact to a young man who ran incessantly and persistently through the London streets? In a main road, he might hope to create the illusion that he was merely running for a bus. But in these obscure, aristocratic byways, he couldn't but feel that an officious policeman might stop him to explain matters. At this juncture in his thoughts, a taxi, with flag erect, turned the corner of the street ahead. Tommy held his breath. Would they hail it? He drew a sigh of relief as they allowed it to pass unchallenged. Their course was a zigzag, one designed to bring them as quickly as possible to Oxford Street. When at length they turned into it, proceeding in an easterly direction, Tommy slightly increased his pace. Little by little he gained on them. On the crowded pavement there was little chance of his attracting their notice, and he was anxious, if possible, to catch a word or two of their conversation. In this he was completely foiled. They spoke low, and the din of the traffic drowned their voices effectually. Just before the Bond Street tube station, they crossed the road, Tommy, unperceived, faithfully at their heels, and entered the Big Lions. There they went up to the first floor and sat at a small table in the window. It was late, and the place was thinning out. Tommy took a seat at the table next to them, sitting directly behind Whittington in case of recognition. On the other hand, he had a full view of the second man and studied him attentively. He was fair, with a weak, unpleasant face, and Tommy put him down as being either a Russian or a Pole. He was probably about 50 years of age. His shoulders cringed a little as he talked, and his eyes, small and crafty, shifted unceasingly. Having already lunched heartily, Tommy contented himself with ordering a Welsh rabbit and a cup of coffee. Whittington ordered a substantial lunch for himself and his companion. Then, as the waitress withdrew, he moved his chair a little closer to the table and began to talk earnestly in a low voice. The other man joined in. Listen as he would, Tommy could only catch a word here and there, but the gist of it seemed to be some directions or orders which the big man was impressing on his companion, and with which the latter seemed from time to time to disagree. Whittington addressed the other as Boris. Tommy caught the word Ireland several times, also propaganda, but of Jane Finn there was no mention. Suddenly, in a lull in the clatter of the room, he got one phrase entire. Whittington was speaking. Ah, but you don't know Flossie. She's a marvel. An archbishop would swear she was his own mother. She gets the voice right every time, and that's really the principal thing. Tommy did not hear Boris's reply, but in response to it, Whittington said something that sounded like, "Of course, only in an emergency." Then he lost the thread again. But presently, the phrases became distinct again, whether because the other two had insensibly raised their voices or because Tommy's ears were getting more attuned, he couldn't tell. But two words certainly had a most stimulating effect upon the listener. They were uttered by Boris, and they were, "Mr. Brown." Whittington seemed to remonstrate with him, but he merely laughed. "Why not, my friend? It's a name most respectable, most common. Did he not choose it for that reason? Ah, I should like to meet him, Mr. Brown.
There was a steely ring in Whittington's voice as he replied.
Who knows? You may have met him already.
Bah! Retorted the other. That is children's talk. A fable for the police. Do you know what I say to myself sometimes? That he is a fable invented by the inner ring, a bogey to frighten us with. It might be so.
And it might not.
I wonder. Or is it indeed true that he's with us and amongst us, unknown to all but a chosen few? If so, he keeps his secret well. And the idea is a good one, yes. We never know. We look at each other. One of us is Mr. Brown.
Which?
He commands, but also he serves. Among us, in the middle of us, and no one knows which he is.
With an effort, the Russian shook off the vagary of his fancy. He looked at his watch.
Yes, said Whittington, we might as well go.
He called the waitress and asked for his bill.
Tommy did likewise,
and a few moments later was following the two men down the stairs.
Outside, Whittington hailed a taxi and directed the driver to go to Waterloo.
Taxis were plentiful here, and before Whittington's had driven off, another was drawing up to the curb in obedience to Tommy's peremptory hand.
Follow that other taxi, directed the young man.
Don't lose it.
The elderly chauffeur showed no interest. He merely grunted and jerked down his flag. The drive was uneventful. Tommy's taxi came to rest at the departure platform just after Whittington's. Tommy was behind him at the booking office. He took a first-class single ticket to Bournemouth. Tommy did the same. As he emerged, Boris remarked, glancing up at the clock,
"You're early. You have nearly half an hour."
Boris's words had aroused a new train of thought in Tommy's mind. Clearly, Whittington was making the journey alone, while the other remained in London. Therefore, he was left with a choice as to which he would follow. Obviously, he could not follow both of them unless... Like Boris, he glanced up at the clock, and then to the announcement board of the trains. The Bournemouth train left at 3:30. It was now 10 past. Whittington and Boris were walking up and down by the bookstall. He gave one doubtful look at them, then hurried into an adjacent telephone box. He dared not waste time in trying to get hold of Tuppence. In all probability, she was still in the neighborhood of South Audley Mansions. But there remained another ally. He rang up the Ritz and asked for Julius Hersheimer. There was a click and a buzz. Oh, if only the young American was in his room. There was another click, and then, "Hello," in unmistakable accents, came over the wire.
"That you, Hersheimer?"
"Beresford speaking. I'm at Waterloo. I followed Whittington and another man here. No time to explain. Whittington's off to Bournemouth at 3:30. Can you get there by then?"
The reply was reassuring.
"Sure, I'll hustle."
The telephone rang off. Tommy put back the receiver with a sigh of relief. His opinion of Julius's power of hustling was high. He felt instinctively that the American would arrive in time. Whittington and Boris were still where he'd left them. If Boris remained to see his friend off, all was well. Then Tommy fingered his pocket thoughtfully. In spite of the carte blanche assured to him, he had not yet acquired the habit of going about with any considerable sum of money on him. The taking of the first-class ticket to Bournemouth had left him with only a few shillings in his pocket. It was to be hoped that Julius would arrive better provided. In the meantime, the minutes were creeping by. 3:15, 3:20, 3:25, 3:27. Supposing Julius didn't get there in time. 3:29. Doors were banging. Tommy felt cold waves of despair pass over him. Then a hand fell on his shoulder.
"Here I am, son,"
Your British traffic beats description. Put me wise to the crooks right away. That's Whittington, there, getting in now, that big dark man. The other is the foreign chap he's talking to. I'm on to them. Which of the two's my bird?
Tommy had thought out this question.
Got any money with you?
Julius shook his head, and Tommy's face fell.
I guess I haven't more than $300 or $400 with me at the moment, explained the American.
Tommy gave a faint whoop of relief.
Oh, Lord, you millionaires! You don't talk the same language. Climb aboard the lugger. Here's your ticket. Whittington's your man.
Me for Whittington, said Julius darkly. The train was just starting as he swung himself aboard.
So long, Tommy.
The train slid out of the station.
Tommy drew a deep breath. The man Boris was coming along the platform towards him. Tommy allowed him to pass and then took up the chase once more. From Waterloo, Boris took the tube as far as Piccadilly Circus. Then he walked up Shaftesbury Avenue, finally turning off into the maze of mean streets around Soho. Tommy followed him at a judicious distance. They reached at length a small, dilapidated square. The houses there had a sinister air in the midst of their dirt and decay. Boris looked round, and Tommy drew back into the shelter of a friendly porch. The place was almost deserted. It was a cul-de-sac, and consequently no traffic passed that way. The stealthy way the other had looked round stimulated Tommy's imagination. From the shelter of the doorway, he watched him go up the steps of a particularly evil-looking house and rap sharply, with a peculiar rhythm, on the door. It was opened promptly. He said a word or two to the doorkeeper, then passed inside. The door was shut to again. It was at this juncture that Tommy lost his head. What he ought to have done, what any sane man would have done, was to remain patiently where he was and wait for his man to come out again. What he did do was entirely foreign to the sober common sense which was, as a rule, his leading characteristic. Something, as he expressed it, seemed to snap in his brain. Without a moment's pause for reflection, he too went up the steps and reproduced as far as he was able the peculiar knock. The door swung open with the same promptness as before. A villainous-faced man with close-cropped hair stood in the doorway. "Well," he grunted.
It was at that moment that the full realization of his folly began to come home to Tommy. But he dared not hesitate. He seized at the first words that came into his mind.
"Mr. Brown," he said.
To his surprise, the man stood aside.
"Upstairs," he said, jerking his thumb over his shoulder. "Second door on the left."